This is Global Media News on OWWR Old Westbury Web Radio. I'm Miguel Castro.
And I'm Ben Lubman.
This week in Global Media News, we have media news from Italy, India, South Africa, the Middle East, Japan, and China.
From Italy.
Are there too many smartphones and selfie sticks in Venice?
From South Africa.
South Africans are using social media to expose racism and sexism.
From the Middle East.
Just how popular is Facebook in the Middle East?
From Japan.
Would you like to marry your favorite anime character?
From China.
What is Zepto, the new avatar builder in China?
And what are Weibo's plans for world domination?
All this and more coming to you live on OWWR Old Westbury Web Radio, streaming live from the State University of New York College at Old Westbury. Emily Sorella is here to talk to us about social media in Italy. Italians just like their smartphones and social media just like the rest of us. But there has been a growing backlash about visitors in Italy using smartphones while on holiday. Emily, what's the problem according to some Italians?
Venice is calling on some tourists visiting their beautiful city to be respectful and not pause too long on bridges. A new campaign suggests tourists are more cautious of everyday life when visiting a city that they're traveling to for sightseeing as a global playground. To solve this issue, Italians have come up with their own type of solution. The launch of communications campaign that will be designed differently for each city. Venice, Italy was the first to launch a new program following the hashtag on social media, hashtag enjoy respect Venezia. Hashtags give more significant meanings to things, especially when campaigning worldwide issues. Hashtags are extremely beneficial when it comes to getting something globally viral due to social media being the fastest, easiest, most productive spread of news. This technique contradicting the use of social media to end the obnoxious use of technology in these cities. It is funny, but this campaign idea will not go virally through social media to end media abuse in cities like these, but Italians agreed that it will help spread the use of less social media so everyday life can continue.
Has the tourist rate gone skyrocketing in any specific place in Italy?
Not specifically, but along with Venice being a popular city to visit, Florence, Italy has one of the highest ranking cities for tourists in the world. In 2012, the number of tourists was around 8 million, and later 2017 became 10.2 million. Italians have been getting more and more upset about the amount of people that come to their beautiful city on their phones and cameras. These people are extremely eager to post their fancy pictures on social media to get as many viewers as possible, along with people just innocently taking pictures and posting on media. People want to do more and more immature and silly things in these public places to post for fame or entertainment. This can also cause a disturbance in everyday life. In summer of 2016, a tourist who jumped off the Vitalia Belgian teenagers made a video of him jumping off the bridge into the canal and made it go viral via social media. Their consequences included going publicly apologizing for their behavior.
So why is this seen as such a problem?
This is becoming a problem with tourists having to constantly post, always using their devices to put things on the media, and stopping too long to take their phones out and capture the beauty in the chaos, in this chaos that others call home.
Is there a time period when these cities are more busy than others?
There are seasons that are less busy and more busy with the amount of people who are visiting and when people have time off back in the United States, but all year round there are visitors, and the Florentine posts that Easter rolls around in the city, and once again it's a host to millions of people. They huff and they puff across bridges, and they dodge selfie sticks while attempting to reach a government office or just getting to work, when they almost get hit by people who don't pay attention, and it's just the crowds, and people are seeming to become more and more chaotic as the days go on. People not only have been recently complaining about the tourists, but the media for at least a century now, so the crowds have gotten worse and worse over time. Florentine officials were trying to figure out a way to reserve this ongoing trend with the hashtag. And for Global Media News, I'm Emily Sorella, passing it back to you, Miguel.
Thanks, Emily. We have Logan Mitchell here talking about WhatsApp in India and how farmers are using it in their daily lives. How can you tell us about it, Logan?
So in India, there are certain regions that don't have as much access to the internet as they would like, because this access to the internet through their government and through, you know, all these organizations, they could be finding out information on how to farm better and new technologies and new ways to, you know, make their production more efficient. So through WhatsApp, a group was created that basically joined together across India all different farmers from different areas sharing news about what worked on their farms, what didn't work, new ways that they could produce and new ways that they can make more money, basically, from their farming. So these WhatsApp groups connected them in a way that they were, you know, not able to do before when they were just, you know, on their farm sharing information with neighbors. Now they were able to reach across India into faraway places and learn new things about farming. And then through WhatsApp, because of this idea, other people started to form their own businesses, like a buying and selling business. So a woman in a building would, you know, be really good at making cakes or pies, and she would use a WhatsApp group to share with her Indian neighbors or, you know, people in neighboring towns, so they could come and either kind of barter and give them food that they make in return for food that, you know, she made, and vice versa, or they would use money. But basically, they're using WhatsApp to connect on ways and, you know, through food and through WhatsApp in ways that they weren't able to do before.
Using WhatsApp and these farmers, quite the communication that they have going on. Do they use, like, said group chats, or do they just talk one-on-one?
Yeah, so they're using these group chats, and there are so many people within these group chats that the ideas are just almost endless. People just go and go and go and share all of their ideas. So it's really helping them learn, and it's really helping farmers just share their expertise, and everything is just becoming a lot clearer for them because of WhatsApp, because of these groups.
Yeah, that's crazy, especially when you think about, like, WhatsApp being more, like, we use it just to talk to our friends and stuff.
Right.
They're making a living out of it.
Exactly. And since they're farmers, it's, you know, it's an agricultural business. You don't really think technology would be as important as it is becoming now. But now they're using their phones and using WhatsApp to make farming more successful. So it's just a cool connection there.
Gotcha. I also liked what you said about how they are getting both in contact with other people that have other resources or other talents. Like you said, that maybe they could farm something new, or they could try to get talent.
Yeah, they have new, more efficient ways that they may not have been able to figure out without this WhatsApp group, because people across the country are now sharing things that were not, it wasn't accessible through the internet, through government controls and all that. So this WhatsApp group is really changing the way they're farming. And from Global Media News, I'm Logan Mitchell.
Welcome back to Global Media News. I'm Ben Lubman. South Africa is a country with a lot of politics. It is a democracy with a very active media sector. South Africans are using their smartphones and social media to engage in political debates and conversations. Brandon Johnson is here to report about the role of social media in South African politics. Brandon, what drew you to this story?
Hey, Ben. Thanks, man. Yeah, what really drew me to this topic is that it's very interesting how I speak about Africa a lot, right? Because this is the motherland where most of us come from, and that it's some place where, you know, you don't hear too much about, except like the beauty of like South Africa, certain things in South Africa that we take for granted, you know, because it is a beautiful land. I really chose this topic because I want to understand more about politics out there, because it seems to be a problem right now, as South African journalists have been attacked by political groups. You know, one of the biggest things that's been going on right now, and as far as social media goes, it's been very active. According to businesstech.com, local Twitter numbers have grown in the past couple of years. According to business.com, they have approximately 7.7 million South Africans on Twitter, which is an increase. And Facebook is one of the biggest apps that they use out there. And they're not even saying that the younger generation is starting to go away from Facebook. They still are very actively using it. You know what I mean? So I think that's one of the most important things. And when you want to get news and media out there in the world, and you want to express yourself, I've said this plenty of times before, in Tanzania and Uganda, how they have, you know, social media tax, and, you know, you're limited to the amount of things you can do. I mean, South Africa is a little different. People out there are just very used to being targeted against each other. So recently, excuse me if I'm saying this wrong, the Ekurhuleni Economic Freedom Fighters group, that's a big group out there, political group in South Africa. Their council, his name is Mampuru Mampuru. He posted an email and sent it to his colleagues that another man was referring black people as monkeys. I mean, that's a, you know, very racial statement to say. I mean, come on now. So the whole point of this, you know, I asked myself a question, right? Is this like another way of like political banter? The guy actually posted it on Twitter and, you know, it went big. You know, it was like a whole lot of people were commenting, reposting the tweet. And Twitter, like I mentioned, is a big app out there that they use. Getting the news out there to the general public was very important for him. But the guy, you know, he quote unquote denied the allegations that he never sent that letter. And I reserve all rights in this regard. And he actually has a supporting too from his CCMA commissioner, who said that they mistakenly sent this to his colleagues and that this is the same racist who kicked me out sitting because I questioned his attitude towards the workers. They said, quote unquote, the bastard is open racist. So, you know, there's a lot of tension going on, and that's according to the Citizens.com, one of South Africa's biggest news, platform that they use. So when it comes to corruption, I feel like it's not only dealing with financial problems, because you all know, you look at our country, you know what I'm saying? We got so much corruption going on. The Mueller case, you know, the Russian probe. I mean, it's so many things that we have been doing, you know, very bad. It makes us look bad as a nation. And also, there was another scandal that I want to point out that a guy, you know, he had a political sex scandal. And it's not like one of those big sex scandals where he's with another woman. It was basically, you know, he recorded a video on his phone of him and his wife. But it became like a big thing because, you know, people are trying to basically blackmail him and, you know, they hacked his system. Mm. So, I mean, that was just pretty sad and unfortunate. It's like you can't even like do anything with your own wife. I mean, like, come on, man. He's just trying to live life or whatever the case is. I'm not trying to get into all the details, but his name is Malusu Gigaba. He's a minister of home affairs. So that's a big deal. He had to be in front of the court. They basically said that he lied under oath and that goes against the Constitution. So he's in big trouble for that. But he made a quote on Twitter saying, "My wife and I have learned with regret and sadness that a video containing material of sexual nature meant for our eyes only, which was stolen from my communication, got illegally intercepted. My phone got hacked and it's circulating among certain political figures." The political aspect out there is very big, and anything you do, you can do something as minor as this and then you're gonna get, you know, trashed, you know what I mean? So it's like a big deal out there in Africa. So, you know, hopefully, you know, my next story, maybe not on Africa, I'll probably go somewhere else, you know, but as far as Africa, I'm really like interested in like how everything comes together. And also, that's according to News 24, another big South African news source. So that's me, and that's my story right there. So back to you, Ben.
Thanks. I actually have a question for you.
Yeah, sure.
So going back a little bit, how have journalists in South Africa like been attacked? Like, are some of the things
that have happened? Like I mentioned, the political party, EFF, they basically threatened them, saying that, you know, they're not allowed to go to press conferences and stuff like that. And that was a big deal because, like, that's the media. They got to report stuff. Sometimes, you know, when, like, news media is, like, remember how, like, Donald Trump says CNN tells fake news? Mm-hmm. So they basically feel the same way. Like, they're saying bad things about them because they're tarnishing their image. And I don't think that's the case. They're just reporting what's live. And even the South African National Editors Forum said that they won't even post their news. I'm Brandon Johnson. Back to you, Ben.
Thanks, Brandon. Let's head north to the Middle East. Samantha Capobianco has a report for us about the popularity of Facebook in the Middle East and about what Facebook has been doing to make Facebook into an important marketing and advertising medium in this market. Samantha, what can you tell us about Facebook in the Middle East?
So Facebook in the Middle East is taking advantage of those shared informative videos and allowing businesses to monetize them by putting pop-up ads before, during, and after them. So like similar to YouTube, how they have like their like ad breaks, that's what they're doing to Facebook videos. And it's a new way of advertisement because it is so popular in the Middle Eastern region. And then according to Jonathan Laban, he's Facebook's managing director for the Middle East, North Africa, and Pakistan. Facebook can narrow its audience down to male or female age group, spending power, location, and much more thanks to like the like button. So like based on what people like, they like monitor that.
Mm-hmm.
And like basically put ads based on that, on their videos. So then he said, what this means on the ground in this region is this. The conversations that I had with advertisers 5 years ago was about the number of likes on Facebook. Today they want business results. And then he gave an example. So for example, like when we speak with Mercedes, for example, it's about how many leads are you creating for me, and it works. Our relationship is great because we are one of the best lead generation platforms in the region. So basically, because Facebook is capable of all of this for a company, they're excited about these ad breaks that they're now able to monetize, because they know it'll reach the target audience that they desire, and it makes Facebook the perfect platform for them to use. So for Global Media News, I'm Samantha Capobianco. Back to you, Ben.
Thanks, Samantha. So, Zepeto, made by a South Korean game developer, Snowcore, is a networking app that is sweeping China. It lets you create an avatar and includes social networking features like connecting real-life friends, interacting with other avatars that are nearby to the real-life user, sending self-made emoticons, and creating photo booth-style pictures. It also supports DMs and a minigame. According to scmp.com, Zepeto follows hot on the heels of other hit apps that offer messaging, live streaming, beautifying, and customization tools as China's restless youth seek to carve out their own individual identities and personal brands in a society once known for its general conformity. Consumer tastes can be fickle, though, as youngsters constantly search for what is new and cool. For example, short video apps like TikTok, where users film and watch seconds-long video clips, quickly caught the attention of young Chinese netizens, and today about 3 in 4 internet users in China use short video apps to entertain themselves, according to a September report from the China Internet Network Information Center, a state agency. I learned this next one from Radii China, it's R-A-D-I-I China. Zepeto uses facial recognition software, not unlike the Mii Maker on the 3DS, if you remember that one, to render a character for you that can then be fine-tuned instead of choosing from presets or making you start from scratch. Saves you a bit of time, doesn't it? The characters you can make are pretty not ugly, which is more than I can say for the old Bitmoji style. You remember that one? Bitmojis, they were so ugly.
Oh,
back
God.
On Snapchat.
Yeah.
I do have to say that the funniest thing about it is something I found on technode.com. Even though it's wildly popular in China, the app itself doesn't actually have a Chinese language mode.
If you were able to, would you use this service?
Yeah, it has an English language mode, actually. But it's really broken English. Like, when it takes your profile picture, it says, just one taking. And when it makes you look nicer, like the beautifying feature, it says, stylisher.
Stylisher. I need that, like, above me at all times. Other than that, do you think that this could possibly be, like, a good engagement tool, not just for their set audience, but possibly branch out just due to the fact that it seems kind of fun?
Yeah, I think it could get really, really popular. I mean, right now it sits at the very top of the Chinese Android and Apple app stores. Like, it's been three days, like, since this thing got popular, and it's already at the tippy top. For Global Media News, I'm Ben Lubman. Back to you, Miguel.
Thank you, Ben. We have Brendan Lipford on the Japanese media beat for us. He is here to tell us about a wedding. Brendan, what is so special about this wedding, and what does it tell us about media in Japan?
Well, what's so special about this wedding is that a man named Akihiko Kendo just married his wife, which happens to be a hologram, an AI hologram called Hatsune Miku.
You probably
heard of her. She's very popular in Japan, but also a little bit here in the West.
I don't know what I'm more upset about, the fact that somebody married Hatsune Miku, or that Hatsune Miku is no longer single.
Yeah, Hatsune Miku is no longer single, ladies and gentlemen, who wants to marry her. And that he paid about $17,000 for his wedding with Hatsune Miku. It went off without a hitch, except one thing: his mother did not attend the wedding.
Understandable.
Oh, that's so sad to hear about. I've heard about other people, like a guy married a body pillow.
Yes.
You remember a couple years back, a guy married, I don't remember the game because I think it was released only in Japan, but it was a 3DS
released.
Game.
Yes, it was.
Yeah, you remember that one?
Yes, I do remember
he married
that one.
It. That was weird.
He took her everywhere on vacation.
it's so weird.
Everywhere, anytime he had some free time, he always opened her up and took her out. They even did a news segment on him, and
it's beautiful.
Yes, and he was like at a restaurant, and he had her open and everything else. Yeah.
So I gotta ask, I have to ask.
Yeah.
What is your stance on the whole waifu thing?
Oh wow, what is my stance? I have nothing to say. It is hard to even describe, but if these people feel like they want to marry inanimate object, not a real person at all, ball power. Go ahead. They're not hurt. If they're not hurting anyone, it's all right. But mostly, I think it's very psychological in some way. It's like you're disconnecting yourself from actual human beings. Like mm-hmm. you and I are talking right now, we're actual human beings, and those things that they that they're marrying are not really real, and yeah. they can't sustain a real relationship with someone else, which is really horrible.
Why are Japanese men marrying fictional characters?
I think it's due to the society they're in, mostly. Mostly these Japanese men are otakus, people that are very willing to go ahead. And like they like anime a lot. They like video games. They're mostly shut-ins. So they don't really go ahead and interact with other people or anything like that. So they're mostly hanging out more at the home. They're not interacting with women or other men. So they're finding comfort in these inanimate objects and finding solace in them. Kendo, he was bullied by women at his workplace, so he felt very self-conscious. He felt that he couldn't interact with women, and he felt women as nothing more but a liability, nothing at all. So he went and he purchased this technology hologram called Gatebox. And he married his hologram wife. But it's also that some Japanese women do not accept the otaku lifestyle of people liking anime or video games and playing them for a long period of time, which I kind of understand. But there's some women out there that do like anime and video games, so they could approach them if they had the courage to approach them.
So do you think society's to blame for these events?
I think too much consumption of anime probably is a little bit of video games as well, because they're sort of separating themselves from reality. Because I just watched a video on Kendo's wedding, and he said like one thing about having a virtualized girlfriend is that they can never age and they can never die. I feel very very concerned.
Lots of feelings in that one.
From Global Media News, this is Brendan Lifford. Back to you, Ben.
Thanks, Brendan. Up next, we have media news from China. Will Weibo take over the world? My co-host Miguel Castro is here to talk about Weibo. Miguel, give us an introduction to Weibo. What is it, and am I pronouncing it correctly?
Yes, it is Weibo, not Weibo. as many people might just overall generalize it to be due to its foreign-sounding name. Weibo is a Chinese microblogging site, mostly comparable to, imagine a mix of like a Facebook and Twitter, but in China, since you know that China has their own set companies to not have to use the set Facebook or Twitter or Instagram. They have their own companies that reciprocate their own media. So with Weibo, they are currently taking up 25% of the population that is in China is actually using Weibo. And it's quite interesting as they have more than 431 million monthly active users, which is nuts. And they are slowly looking to see if they can expand not just on the international market, but looking to see if they can get their content to become a basis or a staple for foreign speakers. So the method that they're using this is that they are currently, even though they're not looking to expand and make services for any locations or countries outside of China, they are currently looking, what they're doing is that they're integrating new languages into their shows and movies, or well, into their programming and content specifically. So if they have any web series or on their site, they will have an option to listen to it in English. Any specific area that they're looking to capture an audience in, which is really great because as they've been encapsulated with just Chinese and Chinese media and focusing on the Chinese audience, by expanding on these language abilities, they could genuinely find a good following and may not just be more profitable, but have more outreach. For a lot of these Chinese companies, as big as they might be, they won't really be known outside of China. So this could be very, very interesting to see China not just making its own mark on the media and technology industry, but possibly using their influence on the everyday citizen in England or here in the United States. An interesting part of this is that they're not just looking to do it through set information or content. They're actually looking right now to potentially getting into a bid war over sports rights, which would be interesting because this microblogging site, it's mostly just commenting and Facebook and stuff like that. But they do have their occasional content of like linked videos or any specific stars that they have. So if they would get the extremely expensive rights to like a Premier League or like any sports league, they could generally become a great method, not just for Chinese media users to be encapsulated on the world of outside media, but by broadcasting their own shows and making it adaptable or understandable to other audiences, it genuinely could captivate a whole new area of globalization. And it's really interesting to see what they can do.
So you keep saying the phrase microblogging. What is microblogging?
Twitter. With Twitter, you see people making small posts of 100. How many characters?
I don't know.
Like it was 150 to 290, I believe.
I think so.
And it's like a very limited and sum up version of your thoughts. One of my favorite podcasts, actually, Steve Dangle, he talks on how microblogging is Twitter. On Twitter, you just comment and you try to sum everything up in as neat and as concise as possible. And he says that if you make more than one tweet regarding something, if there's multiple tweets regarding something, that shouldn't be on Twitter. That's more of a blog post.
Mm.
So in terms of microblogging, that's the closest I could tell you. Like, they'll have short descriptions of what their content is, or they'll make short announcements that are direct and to the point.
So you think microblogging is basically any mass used website, like Tumblr's microblogging, Facebook is microblogging, Twitter's microblogging. Everything's basically microblogging now because blogging's kind of out of loop now.
Oh yeah, I mean, in the sense of how our attention span goes down like way too low, I think that everything kind of has to go from full on blogs and stories to microblogging just to captivate the audience and continue that overall content, be keeping up with the user base. So for example, if someone makes a huge post about something that I really care about, there'll be rants on r/hockey on Reddit. And I'll just be like, I'll read the first two sentences. If they're not energetic enough or if I'm not invested enough in it, even if I want to know what they want to say, I'm not going to read it. I'm going to scroll all the way down.
To the TLDR.
TLDR. If someone can tell me what he said in a sentence or two, that's all that matters to me.
Of course.
So if this microblogging site can somewhat give out the content that they need and in as concise way that they have in terms of the microblogging standpoint that they have, I would love a 1 minute or 2 minute update of the news or any updates on what's going on in sports. What I do right now is I don't have time to look at the news because they deviate from what's going on. So they'll start off the news and they'll say, this crazy thing just happened. But first off, there's a puppy, and like they'll transition to something that doesn't matter and they'll hold off the biggest, juiciest news, either start it off and then like fade in and fade out, or they'll mention something big, but they won't get around to it until you realize you've seen the whole show. I don't like that. That's, in my opinion, it's a television version of clickbait, where you end up in a video. It's like, oh my God, this dog did a backflip. And then it's a 12-minute video on how they spent their day. And then at the 11-minute mark, someone like grabs him and does a backflip. It's not even a real thing. So that's my opinion. So microblogging and a sense of even on YouTube, like even having videos of microblogging is a great direct to the point method that could reach consumers very well. For me, I'd love it. And if someone needed more detail on it or wanted it, they could go to sources like Tumblr or Reddit that would explain it further on. But in terms of the average audience, I think that overall, Weibo is the way to go in terms of keeping things concise. From Global Media News, I'm Miguel Castro. Back to you, Ben.
Thanks, Miguel. That's all for this week. Thanks for hosting with me, man. It's been a gas. This is our last webcast, and it's been a pleasure, all of them.
Absolute
heart. Our engineer is Brandon Johnson, and our producer, as always, is Kristen Brave.
Global Media News is brought to you by OWWR, Old Westbury Web Radio, live from the Media and Communications Department here at SUNY Old Westbury, the College at Old Westbury.
Today we heard reports from Samantha Capobianco, Miguel Castro, Emily Sorella, Brandon Johnson, Brendan Lipford, myself, and Logan Mitchell. For more Medium news and resources, check out our latest posts on globalmedianews.org, where you can listen to all of our webcasts and even subscribe to our podcast feed.
Follow us on Twitter at OWWRGMN. Use our Twitter feed to keep up with the latest news for aspiring journalists and media professionals. That's at OWWRGMN.
Signing off for the last time, I'm Ben Lubman.
And I'm Miguel Castro.
Stay tuned for more great programming coming up next on OWWR, Old Westbury, Web Radio.